You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to today's event about gaining strength, the rise of the renminbi. And today's event is hosted by Brookings Tsinghua Center for Public Policy and co-hosted by the Penn Wharton China Center and International Monetary Institution. And thank you all for coming here and joining our discussion today. Well, the issue of Chinese yuan has been a very important topic, and it has gaining traction lately. Just a month ago, on October 1st, 2016, we all witnessed the historic step for the Chinese currency. The International Monetary Fund has officially included the currency into its special drawing right basket, granting the currency a status of global reserve currency. It is a result of China's growing economic clout, continuous reforms of the financial system, and efforts to make currency more widely used in international trade. But is the move a real game changer or just of symbolism? What does it mean for Chinese economy, especially when it is facing substantial downward pressure? And what does it entail for China's ongoing financial reforms? And what role would China play in world economic affairs with the rise of the Chinese currency? So to address these important issues, I'm very pleased to introduce Professor Ashwa Prasad. And he will share with us his insights on his new book, Gaining Currency, The Rise of the Renminbi, which was published by Oxford University last month. Professor Prasad is a senior fellow at Brookings Institution, where he hosts the New Century Chair in International Economics. And he's also the Tulane Senior Professor of Trade Policy and Professor of Economics at Cornell University. And he was previously Chief of the Financial Studies Division at International Monetary Fund. And before that, he was Head of IMF's China Division. And we also have the honor to have three distinguished panelists joining him to discuss China's growing economic clout and rise of Chinese currency. And they include, from the right to the left, Michelle Mayer, Taiwan Tsai Professor Emeritus, Emeritus Professor of Management at Wharton Business School, University of Pennsylvania, and Zheng Shengling, Professor of Banking and Finance, and also Dean at Academy of Internet Finance at Zhejiang University, and Xiang Songzuo, Deputy Director at the International Monetary Institution. Well, I should mention that Professor Ben is also the Executive Director at the IMI at the Renmin University of China. Thank you for our distinguished panelists joining us discussions today. And Professor Prasad will first deliver about 35 minutes presentation about the rise of Chinese renminbi, and then we'll move on to a 40-minute panel discussion with our panelists here. And then the floor will be open to Q&A from our audiences presented here today. So without further ado, let's give a warm welcome to Professor Ashwa Prasad.
Good afternoon, and thank you very much for coming. So and thank you for the kind introduction, Ms. Guan. So, the Chinese RMB has certainly come a very long way in a very short period of time. And it is remarkable that we are sitting here today talking about a currency that has, in principle, already ascended to the club of elite reserve currencies. And who would have thought it, just thinking about where the RMB was a few years ago. But as Ms. Guan pointed out, there are important questions that this elevation of the RMB to this elite status raises. How did China get to this stage? What are the implications for China's own economy and for the rest of the world? And what are the prospects of the RMB becoming a more important international currency over time. So in my talk, I intend to focus not just on the implications for the international monetary system, but also for China's own domestic development, because I think there is an interesting story to be told here about what RMB internationalization has meant in terms of Chinese economic reforms. And there are some interesting analytical issues here about how to think about whether China has adopted the right approach or the right sequence to how it does various things like capital account opening, making the exchange rate more flexible, which are all seen as necessary for a country to have its currency become a reserve currency. And certainly the process of becoming a reserve currency does create some risks in itself. So we will talk about that as well. But the more interesting part of the story actually goes back not a few years ago, but many centuries ago. As I started writing the book, I came upon some fascinating facts which I had not known, even though I've been working on China for about a decade and a half. It turns out that, in fact, China had the very first paper currency in the world, which some of you probably already know. It was during the Song Dynasty in the 7th century. At the time, the notion that a paper currency really could not work very well as a substitute for, you know, real currencies created in the form of either commodities or precious metals. And in fact, some of the debates about currency go back even further. Many of the debates that we have these days about the role of the government in issuing money and so on actually took place in the 2nd century BC, when Confucian scholars were debating the right role of the government in issuing finance. Many Confucian scholars apparently took the view that in fact it's better to have private agents or private institutions issue money. At the time it was just commodity money, because if you had private agents competing, then in fact you could have the value of money being preserved through competition. The sovereign at the time felt that in fact only the government should have the privilege of issuing currency. There was a very famous historian that I'm sure all of you have heard about, Sima Qian, who was a Confucian scholar, but he in fact took the position of the government in that stage, saying that in fact the sovereign government would be better at preserving the value of the currency. So many of these debates in China have their resonance in the present day. While China had the first paper currency in the world, things get even more interesting in the 13th century, when the Yuan dynasty took power in China. And the Yuan dynasty's prime ruler, of course, was Kublai Khan. Now, we know from the writings of Marco Polo, who went back to Europe and reported on this wonderful alchemy that this Grand Khan had come up with, because in the 7th century, it turns out that in the 13th century, paper money had not come to Europe. In fact, paper money came to Europe only in the 17th century. So at the time, the notion of money that was not backed up by commodities or precious metals was a very strange thought. How can you have money that is just printed on paper? So Marco Polo writes that this Grand Khan, as he calls him, has discovered the best form of alchemy. He just puts his imprint on mulberry bark, which is what paper was made of at the time, and everybody throughout the land accepts the money. So how did Kublai Khan make his currency into fiat currency that was accepted throughout the land? Very simple. He passed a decree saying that anybody who did not accept this currency would lose his life. That turned out to be very effective in making the currency into a fiat currency. But of course, the temptation to print money was too strong. And what happened is that you had one of the first episodes of hyperinflation soon after Kublai Khan passed away, and a subsequent member of the Yuan dynasty ended up having to print too much money to finance war. So you had among the first episodes of hyperinflation. What you have behind me on the screen is a printing plate and also an actual note from one of the Yuan dynasty notes, and the text at the bottom, for those of you who can read it, is probably obvious, but what it says is basically that it talks about some characteristics of the notes and then points out that counterfeiters will be put to death, and that anybody reporting the counterfeiters will not only get a monetary reward, but will also get all the family property of the counterfeiters. Now, with the episodes of hyperinflation, what happened is that paper currency started disappearing because people didn't recognize its value anymore. And it was only in the Song dynasty in the 13th century, after Marco Polo had passed on, that we got paper currency once again appearing. So paper currency in that sense does have a very long tradition dating back to the Song dynasty, and then through the before that the Yuan dynasty. This note that you're seeing here is a Ming dynasty note, which is when currency started playing a prominent role again in the form of paper currency, but even this currency was in fact backed by commodities. And then coming to more recent history, in terms of these are not just the only innovations that China had. Among the first issues of paper currency, the first fiat currency, the first episodes of hyperinflation. By the 1930s, of course, we had the Kuomintang controlling a good chunk of China. And the Kuomintang also had experiments with paper currency, some of which worked, some of which did not work very well. And they too faced the temptation of printing too much money to finance their war expenditures. And you had hyperinflation. That led to the Fa Bi reform in 1938, when the Kuomintang government issued a currency that was in principle backed up by US dollars of British pound sterling. So there was relative monetary stability for a very short period. And then what happened is that you had competition coming from the Japanese, which started annexing certain parts of Chinese territory. And by 1938, they had set up a puppet government, the Wang Jingwei government in Nanjing. Then China had the first currency war. And this was a literal currency war. What happened is that the Japanese set up their own central bank because they recognized that in order to have economic power, you need to have your own currency. The Nanjing government set up a central bank and set up a branch of that central bank in Shanghai, which was a financial center for China at that time already. The Kuomintang government had set up its own central bank, and it too set up a branch in Shanghai. And of course, there was currency competition. So what happened in this competition is that the Kuomintang government's agents then went in and dynamited the central bank branch of the Wang Jingwei government. And in retaliation, the Wang Jingwei government started pulling out employees of the Kuomintang central bank, dragging them out onto the streets and executing them. So there was literally blood on the streets in this currency war. So if you think that currency wars these days are very fierce, it was nothing like the first currency war back in China, which really had blood on the streets. And this is just a picture of many of the struggles that were happening in Shanghai related to some of the currency turbulence of the time. And then, of course, in 1949, the PRC was instituted. And you know, all of this comes from the first chapter of the book, and I could speak about the first chapter of the book for the next 2 hours, because learning about Chinese monetary history turned out to be the most fun part of this book. So if you ever get the book, read the first chapter. The rest of the book, you know, is about exchange rates and capital flows and so on. It's really boring stuff. We'll talk about that, but it's not half as exciting as what is in chapter one. So in 1949, the PRC was formed, but the People's Bank of China was actually formed as the central bank of the New Republic, even before the New Republic was declared. And I have some archival material suggesting that Nan Shen, who was the governor of the People's Bank of China at the time, goes to Mao and says, you are the father of the party, you're the father of the nation, everybody wants your picture to be on the new banknotes. And what Mr. Mao says is, no, I'm just a party functionary, this is, after all, the RMB, the people's money, so my image should not be on it. So it turns out that in the initial series of banknotes that were issued in China, the image of Mao did not appear at all. There were various other images showing different ethnic minorities, different representations of what was considered the idealized society. So for instance, in the third series of banknotes issued in 1982, this was seen in the 50 yuan note as a sort of idealized representation of society. You can see there the intellectual with his glasses, the farm worker and the industrial worker. So this was seen as a perfectly balanced society. It was only in the fourth series of RMB banknotes issued in 1987 that you see four leaders, including Zhou Enlai and Mao, being shown in profile. But still, you don't have the full face, iconic image of Mao that you see on all your yuan notes these days. So what changed? When I used to come to China back in the 90s and so on, I thought this had always been the case, that Mao was always on all the notes. It turns out that it's only in the fifth series of RMB notes that was issued at the 50th anniversary of the PRC's formation. This was issued starting in 1999, that Mao's full face image appears on all the yuan notes. And there too, there is a story. Why did it happen? Was it just because it took so long for the legacy to be realized? It turns out that the managers of the printing agency faced a very severe problem at that time. That problem was counterfeiting of bank notes. So here I have this material showing what the internal deliberations they had, and the members of the printing bureau decided that the best way to limit counterfeiting was to put on all the bank notes an image that everybody would recognize. So there is a long discussion. Should they have Confucius? Should they have one of the other leaders? Should they have one of the famous landmarks in China? No, they decided that the only image that everybody in China would recognize is that of Mao. So that's why you have Mao's full-face iconic image appearing on every banknote now. So if you think about Chinese monetary history, just the sheer history related to the monetary debates in China and the evolution of paper currency is a very interesting story in itself. In fact, to tell you the truth, after collecting all this material, I became so fascinated, this delayed my whole book project by about a month and a half, because I was just reading Chinese monetary history and I was very tempted to write a book just about that. There is so much interesting stuff out there. But in the broader interest of trying to think about where we are right now, we get back to the somewhat more boring stuff. So, in thinking about what the RMB has accomplished, it's useful first to lay out some concepts. So I'm a professor, and as the professors always do, it's good to start out by defining concepts very clearly before we try to understand how the RMB got to where it is. So there is the concept, of course, of an open capital account, where capital can flow relatively easily across national borders. And then there is the concept of an international currency, a currency that is used widely in trade and finance transactions. Now, it turns out that neither of these is a necessary or sufficient condition for the other. You can have a country that has a fully open capital account, but its currency may not play a very big role in international finance. And then one can think about a currency like the RMB, which belongs to a country that does not have a fully open capital account, but seems to be gaining, as I will show you, some traction as an international currency. But being an international currency and a reserve currency are very different things. You often hear the term RMB internationalization, and that rolls in a variety of things. You hear about the RMB playing a bigger role in international payments. You hear about the RMB becoming part of the IMF's SDR basket. But these are really very different concepts. So a reserve currency is one that is held by foreign central banks as part of their FX reserve portfolios. There are more subtle distinctions about a reserve currency that I will get to, but that's a good operational definition to begin with. Now, starting with a very basic concept, which is that of capital account opening, one question is why? Why bother? One argument, which is the classical argument in international finance, is that if a country has a more open capital account, especially if it is a developing country, it can get more financing from abroad because there is less domestic financing. And if you get more financing, you can invest more and grow faster. That's the classical theory. But I've argued in some of my other research that what I call the indirect or collateral benefits of financial opening are even more important. So if you think about China, China does not need foreign money really, because China has a lot of domestic savings, and in fact China has been exporting capital rather than importing capital. If you think about the amount of reserves that China has accumulated in previous years, what China was doing was basically exporting capital to the rest of the world. But still, there are benefits to be had from capital account opening. If you think about why the Chinese government was so inviting of foreign direct investment, it's because it brings with it a lot of indirect benefits. Technology transfers, better corporate governance and managerial practices, and all of those may be even more important than just the money itself. You also get opportunities for domestic investors to diversify their portfolios, perhaps get better returns, but more importantly, get more diversification in their portfolios. And if you think about China's relatively closed capital account, that means that a lot of the saving in China goes into the banking system, which therefore has less of an incentive to reform itself. If Chinese households, corporations have the ability to take money abroad, there is less of a captive deposit base, so it forces some degree and catalyzes. That means generates a push for financial sector reforms. But there are lots of questions about whether China is going about it just the right way. What economic theory tells us is if you open up the capital account and allow capital to flow in and out before you have good financial systems, good regulation, that's going to create a lot of risks. Likewise, if you try to manage the currency's value, that becomes much harder as the capital account becomes more open. Plus, there are risks to the banking system, because if concerns about the banking system rise, then maybe a lot of capital could flow out. And last year, we saw some of these risks coming into play. After August 11, when the PBOC freed up the exchange rate or tried to free up the exchange rate, it led to some capital outflows and a lot of concerns. So maybe China's getting it the wrong way. One could argue that on the other hand, although China did lose about $800 billion of reserves last year, still China has a lot of foreign exchange reserves, and maybe the risks are not that bad. But I think there is a bigger and deeper story here to be thought about why it is that China has gone about it this way. When one thinks about the benefits and risks, one can argue about whether the sequencing is right, whether the trade-offs are right. But I think the more important question is what the process of RMB internationalization has done for China. If you think about what the government did last year, a couple of years ago, the idea of making the RMB an important international currency, especially getting it into the SDR basket, was very, very important in terms of building political support for some very difficult reforms. So if you think about what is necessary to make the RMB a reserve currency, and we'll talk more about this in a few minutes, you need good financial markets, you need a more flexible exchange rate, you need better regulation. Now, independent of what happens with the RMB, these are all very good for China. The problem is that all of these reforms have a lot of opposition. So one could say, how can we get around this opposition? And my view, and I call this a Trojan horse strategy. You've heard about the Trojan horse narrative that, you know, the Trojan horse is seen as a gift, but inside the gift are all these soldiers hiding in there, and that's the real purpose, that you introduce changes, you introduce some important, in this context, reforms rather than soldiers, but doing it with the with this overall framework of trying to make the RMB more important. If you think about what Chinese officials have been telling us, if you read their statements carefully, this begins to hang together. Many people like Governor Zhou, or Mr. Ida when he was head of SAFE, and even now that he's back as the deputy governor of the PBOC. They've all been telling us that, in fact, they will not force the issue of the RMB becoming a major international currency, but if the market wants it, they will facilitate it. And that, I think, is a key distinction, allowing the market to sort of determine what happens to the currency. And over time, China's capital account has become much more open again in order to accomplish these objectives that I think are very important. And right now, if you think about China's overall external balance sheet, that is balance sheet with respect to the rest of the world, you know, China has about $6.3 trillion of foreign assets and about a little over $4.5 trillion of liabilities. So China's overall asset position relative to the rest of the world is that it's a creditor to the tune of about $1.6 trillion. But notice one very interesting thing. If you look at the structure of liabilities and assets, one thing pops up that most of China's assets are in the form of foreign exchange reserves. And where are foreign exchange reserves held? They're held largely in the form of U.S. treasuries, euro government bonds, and other bonds of advanced economies that are paying very, very low rates of return. On the other hand, most investment into China has come in the form of foreign direct investment, which is certainly riskier than investing in advanced economy government bonds or any government bonds, but has potentially higher rates of return. So another way of thinking about the goal of making the RMB an international currency is to get around this very strange imbalance. Now, why is this a strange imbalance? It's a strange imbalance because China is in the very unique position of being a creditor to the rest of the world. So if you're a creditor, if all of you lent me money, I would be paying you back, right? That's the way things are supposed to work. But the remarkable thing is that if you look at the return on China's assets, those have been lower than the returns on China's liabilities. So in fact, even though China is a creditor to the world, that is, the rest of the world owes China a lot of money, if you think about how much money China made on its assets relative to the amount it paid out on its liabilities last year, you think that number is maybe small, positive? No, it turned out it was negative. In fact, China lost $60 billion on its net asset position last year. So this is crazy. It's like I owe money to all of you, and all of you give me some returns because I borrowed from you. If you look at the actual numbers, you can see this is not a pattern just over the last year. If you look at the last 5 or 6 years, the returns have been negative. And in fact, the returns have never been significantly positive. So one would argue that, you know, you hear about one of the benefits of being a reserve currency, that you get low borrowing costs and so on. But I think there is another angle to this, that as China's capital account becomes more open, then one can think about the Chinese Central Bank, the PBOC, not accumulating so many foreign exchange reserves, but instead households, corporations going out and diversifying, and maybe they will hold riskier but higher return assets. In the book I have a comparison with the U.S., and in the U.S., the situation is exactly the opposite. The U.S. on net owes to the rest of the world about $4.5 trillion. So guess how much money the U.S. is paying to the rest of the world. It turns out, in fact, the rest of the world is paying the U.S. So if you look at the net returns on U.S. On the U.S. foreign investment position, the U.S. is earning more on its assets, which is smaller than its liabilities, but on its liabilities, it's paying very little. Why? Because most of the rest of the world owns its assets in the U.S. in the form of U.S. Treasury securities, which pay very low rates of return. So this is another angle when thinking about why capital account opening and accumulation of foreign exchange reserves, which until very recently was the main way China was investing abroad, may not make very much sense for China. So as you can see, there are going to be many different interlocking elements when things about the RMB's position in international finance. because one needs to think about the building blocks, starting from why China might open the capital account, why there might be domestic reasons to promote the RMB's role as an international currency. And as you can see, this is something that the government has, I think, wanted and in fact actively encouraged for some time, that the share of reserve accumulation in how much money China invests in the rest of the world, which is capital outflows, that has been falling not just in the last year or so, but over a few years, while the share of private and other types of outflows has in fact been rising. So let's go back, once we've dealt with the capital account opening issues, and thinking about what the RMB's journey to becoming an international currency looks like. And again, there was, until about a year and a half ago, a huge amount of enthusiasm about how far the RMB had come along on its process of internationalization. You know, offshore yuan deposits have been rising very fast. Trade settlement in yuan now accounts for about nearly one-third of China's trade, and China accounts for about 12% of global trade. So if you take account of both of those, you know, China's currency accounts for payment and settlement of about 2% of global trade transactions. Yuan-denominated bonds have been rising as well. So one question is whether the RMB is on its way to becoming a true international currency. The progress was very rapid. In fact, if you look at any of these measures, the trajectory looks like this. It's very, very impressive. It's starting from zero, of course, and rising very fast. But it turns out that projections that this trend would go on forever clearly proved wrong. In the last 2 years, as pressures on the RMB started shifting from appreciation to depreciation, you saw leveling off. So the settlement of foreign trade in RMB started settling off. If you look at RMB bonds issued in Hong Kong, in fact, the 2015 numbers are just about the level of 2014. And if you think about the RMB's role in global as a payments currency, that number again went from basically zero just about 5-6 years ago to about 2.5% now. You might think 2.5% is not much to write home about, but this was enough to move the RMB to the fifth rank in terms of payment currencies, because the US dollar again turns out to be very dominant, and there aren't that many competitors out there. So even with right now the share is about 1.9% of the RMB has fallen down to the sixth rank, but it's trading places with the Japanese yen practically every other month. And I think this trend will actually continue. So if you look at some of these numbers, the share of turnover in foreign exchange markets, the share of international bonds and notes, the amount of interest rate derivatives denominated RMB, small numbers. But again, it's important to remember that we're starting from zero, and it's pretty rapid progress. So if you think about how much progress China has made in terms of promoting its currency as an international currency, just China's sheer size, its importance in international trade has allowed it to get traction. And its international use, I think, is increasing because the supporting infrastructure is increasing very rapidly. Right now, you have about 15 offshore financial centers, and New York has been designated as an offshore trading center for the RMB just recently. China has its own cross-border payment system that it has set up, and you're getting more integration of the offshore and onshore markets. So I think, although we're seeing a bit of a hiccup right now, the internationalization process will pick up once again and continue. So I think so long as China continues on its path where it takes on a bigger share of global GDP, global trade, the RMB is going to become a more important international currency. Then there is the question of whether it becomes a reserve currency. Now, for a reserve currency, traditionally there are some very standard criteria that are relevant. There is size, whether the country has an open capital account, and a market-determined exchange rate. But in addition, you need good macro policies and well-developed financial markets. Well-developed financial markets, I think, are a critical issue, because ultimately, Again, if you think about markets playing a big role here, foreign investors, both official and private, need to have access to renminbi-denominated financial assets so they can move easily and in and out of those assets, and they need to have good, high-quality renminbi-denominated assets. So you need an open capital account, but you also need good quality assets. In terms of size, China undoubtedly is big. It now accounts for about 1/6 of global GDP. If you look at it in purchasing power parity terms, it's somewhat higher. China accounts for about 12 to 13% of global trade, depending on how you measure it, and about a third of global foreign exchange reserves. So I don't have to tell anybody in this room, China is very big, the second largest economy in the world. It contributed more to global GDP growth since the financial crisis than even the US. So size is clearly not a problem. The currency has become more market determined over time, and of course it has risen quite a bit since 2005 when these are trade weighted exchange rates rather than just the US dollar. CNY US dollar exchange rate, because I think this is a more broad and relevant concept. And as you can see, the RMB is relatively volatile in that dimension. But ultimately, financial markets are the key determinant of reserve currency status. And here again, China is not necessarily falling that short. If you add up the amount of what I might call high quality fixed income assets, again, these are fixed income, whether these are high quality in China is still open to question. But if you add up the amount of outstanding government bonds and corporate bonds, that's over $5 trillion. So China is already ahead of many other reserve currency economies, including Switzerland, Canada, Australia, all of which have reserve currencies. But there is a long way to go. You need to have much broader range of financial instruments. Correct? You need liquidity. You need to have a lot of those instruments. And a fair amount of turnover in those markets. And in all of those dimensions, China is moving forward, but I don't think it's quite there yet. And you need a good trading infrastructure, you need a good regulatory framework so that investors, again, can come in and invest in a sensible, practicable way in these markets. So there are issues that still remain in terms of China's progress towards a reserve currency. Now, here is the interesting thing. If you go back and look at these basic prerequisites that I put up, notice that China certainly has size, but China does not have an open capital account. It does not have a flexible exchange rate. Its financial markets are developing, but they are still relatively underdeveloped. In terms of macroeconomic stability, yes, there are lots of risks in China, but who's to say that China has any worse macroeconomic policies than the advanced economies? But you might think that the open capital account and flexible exchange rate are key criteria, and China doesn't have those. And here is where things get remarkable. No other currency has become a reserve currency without meeting these criteria, but yet, officially today, the RMB is a reserve currency. The IMF has already designated it an elite reserve currency because it joins just four other currencies, the dollar, the euro, the pound sterling, and the Japanese yen, in the IMF's artificial basket of currencies called the special drawing rights. And then, if you look at what the PBOC has done in terms of signing bilateral local currency swap arrangements with other central banks, that is to say, these arrangements give those other counterparty central banks access to RMB liquidity, meaning that all these central banks think it's of some value to have access not just to dollar lines of liquidity from the Fed or from a big central bank like the ECB or the BOJ, but they want these swap lines with the PBOC. There are now 34 of these swap lines, all of which added together amount to about $500 trillion worth of RMB liquidity that foreign central banks have access to. So this is interesting. It means that the currency has become a reserve currency, not just in terms of what the IMF has said, but in terms of how other central banks are treating the currency. And in fact, the IMF estimates that about 1.5% of global foreign exchange reserves are already held in RMB. So the markets are not waiting for what the IMF had to say. So this brings up an interesting question. First of all, is this process going to be stopped by any problems in the Chinese economy? And then we'll get to another even more interesting issue about whether, if China doesn't meet the prerequisites of the reserve currency and has already become a reserve currency, when the day comes that China does have an open capital account, a more flexible exchange rate, maybe it's going to take over. But hold the thought for a second. Let's first think about what could go wrong. There are lots of risks in the Chinese economy. You talk to anybody in financial markets, you know, you can tell a very persuasive story about how China is going to crash today. It should have crashed yesterday, but somehow it didn't, so maybe it will crash tomorrow. And there are many risks out there. There are risks in the financial system. We saw the stock market melting down last year. We had an episode of significant capital flight. And I think there are more fundamental risks related to the policy framework. So stock markets, of course, remain extremely volatile. If you look at what happened with the currency's value relative to the dollar, and no matter what the PBOC tells us all about looking at the market, everybody still looks at the CNY dollar rate. And that certainly took a beating in the last year and a half since August 11, 2015. And more recently, in the last 3 to 4 weeks, the RMB has once again depreciated by about 4% relative to the dollar. And there are clearly tensions in the FX market. If you look at the discrepancy between the onshore and offshore rates, the CNY and CH rates, in principle, these rates should move very close together. But during the period of FX market tensions last year, a pretty significant gap opened up between these two rates. And there are still episodes now when those gaps open up. If you look at capital outflows last year, those were large. And some capital outflows are not a bad thing. As I argued earlier, diversification is actually a good thing from the Chinese point of view. But what the Chinese government, what the PBOC are worried about is capital flight, money going out through unofficial or illegal channels. By definition, it is very hard to say how much money is going out through those channels. One indicator is the measure of what is not accounted for properly in the balance of payments. We call that the net errors and omissions. When economists can't measure something or they don't understand something, they just give it a fancy name in the hope that it makes it seem like we know what is going on. So if we don't understand some part of growth, we call it total factor productivity, so that we sort of hide our ignorance about this. So net errors and omissions are at some level a measure of what we cannot measure. And when net errors and omissions are negative, it means that money is flowing out through unofficial channels, maybe through trade misinvoicing, maybe through money flowing out through the gambling dens in Macau, maybe UnionPay cards being used multiple times on the same day, usually in Macau again. During the period when the RMB was facing appreciation pressures, we had net errors and omissions being positive because money was coming in through unofficial channels. But as you can see, the numbers, once they ramp up to figures like $130 to $140 billion, which was the case for the last 2 years, that suggests that there are significant concerns about the stability of the Chinese economy. And all of these are potential problems. So one can ask, are we in a situation where, in fact, one could have the Chinese economy melting down, which certainly would affect not just the Chinese economy, but this whole process of RMB internationalization? And I would argue that there are enough policy buffers in China that we're not going to have a meltdown. This, of course, is a subject for a whole other seminar. But my sense is that despite all the risks that the Chinese economy faces right now, a financial meltdown is not the most likely scenario. A better way of phrasing the question is to ask, how expensive is it going to be to fix the problems in China, including in particular some of the loans in the banking system, a large number of loans that are never going to be paid back? So many of you in this room are eventually going to be stuck with the bill in some form or another. The question is only how big the bill is going to be and when you will have to pay. But then if you think about as a reserve currency, again, China seems to have arrived and has made more progress than you would have expected based on these criteria. So going back to this other interesting question I posed, one can ask, if China doesn't meet the traditional criteria for reserve currency and is already a reserve currency, maybe when it does have an open capital account, a flexible exchange rate, better financial markets, then China is slowly moving in the right direction in all these areas. So maybe one day, as the Chinese economy grows, you could have the currency become a big enough currency to rival other reserve currencies and maybe even the US dollar. To that, my answer is, under present circumstances, that will not happen. Why is that? Here we have to make a distinction that before the RMB came onto the stage, did not exist at all. It's the distinction between a reserve currency and a safe haven currency. All the reserve currencies that we know of today, other than the RMB, are also safe haven currencies. These are currencies that investors turn to, not just for diversification or yield, but for safety. So in times of financial market turmoil, you see investors running to US dollar denominated bonds, yen denominated bonds, Swiss franc denominated bonds. Until the RMB came along, these were identical concepts because every reserve currency was a safe haven currency. So what is the difference? I listed all these prerequisites for a safe haven currency. What is necessary for a currency to not just be a reserve currency, but also a safe haven currency? In my previous book, which is on the dollar as it turns out, and in this book I argue that in fact what is necessary is that the government needs to have the trust of foreign investors. And what is necessary for trust? It's not just good financial markets and institutions, but you need a broader range of institutions. And what do I mean by institutions? I mean, first of all, an open and transparent system of government with institutionalized checks and balances. Now, I spend a lot of my time in Washington, and you might say I'm completely deluded if I'm arguing that the US political system works very well. Crazy things are happening in the US, but here's the thing. If it was any other country where there was the prospect of a president coming into power who has said that he's willing to walk away from some of the US government debt, you would have panic. You would have people fleeing away from the US, from that country's government bonds. You would have the currency depreciating. What do we see happening in the US? Nothing. Why is that? Because there is a system of checks and balances that we all believe now. After November 9, this whole system of checks and balances may fall apart, and they were giving this talk on November 9, maybe my tune will change, but I think there is a system of checks and balances that will prevent the government or a specific arm of the government, including the executive branch, from doing anything crazy. You also need a trusted and independent central bank, and you need the rule of law. There aren't that many countries in the world where the rule of law is so powerful, the government gets taken to court once in a while, and quite often the government loses. That is very important to engender the trust of foreign investors that if they come in and invest in the country, they're going to be treated fairly according to the rules. They may not like the rules, but once the rules are in place, everybody, including the government, has to obey them. So if you think about what has happened since the global financial crisis, you might think the financial crisis started in the US, that the dollar's share of global FX reserves should have fallen, and of course you had a lot of problems in the US since then, but in fact, since 2008, if anything, the dollar's share of global FX reserves has risen very slightly. And this, I think, goes to showing the power of these institutions that I spoke about. Certainly in Europe, the story is not quite the same. Some of the basic institutions that are holding the Eurozone together are being called into question. So here again, you don't have a complete fleeing out of Eurozone bonds because there are still some parts of the Eurozone where the institutional framework is very strong, but the Euro has suffered as a consequence. But the dollar has barely been affected. So if you think about all these advantages that the U.S. has, these are going to be very difficult to take over. So one question is whether the RMB, if it cannot become a safe haven currency, has reached its limit. I think not. I think as we are seeing from what markets are showing, what central banks are showing, the RMB could become an important currency. In fact, I think as an international currency, almost certainly within the next 3 to 5 years, the RMB will start playing an even more prominent role. If China plays its cards right, with a more open capital account, a more market-determined exchange rate, and a broad range of economic reforms that stabilize growth, maybe not at the present level, but at a reasonable level, then I think the RMB is going to become a significant reserve currency, by which I mean it could rival smaller reserve currencies like even the yen and the pound sterling, which now account for somewhere in the range of 3 to 5% of global FX reserves. It could possibly erode the share of the euro as well, but will it really become a safe haven currency that has the potential to erode the dollar's dominance in global finance? To that, my answer is conditional on there being no broad institutional reforms. And what I see in terms of what President Xi has made very clear, both in terms of words and actions, that broader political, legal, and institutional reforms are off the table. So my sense is that no matter what happens, whether the RMB actually becomes a major reserve currency or not, the next 3 to 5 years are going to be very, very exciting years. Some for the right reasons, because the RMB is going to become more prominent, but there are lots of policy issues within China that I think need to be dealt with, which is going to lead to a lot of volatility. So it's going to be a very interesting ride, one way or the other. So just hang on to your belts and enjoy it while it lasts. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Prasad, for your very inspiring speech. It gave us a clearer picture of where we are now and what are the future directions of Yuan's internationalization, and even with a very specific timeline here. And now let's move on to our panel discussion. Please welcome our very distinguished panelist here, Professor Mayer, Professor Ben, and Dr. Xiang Fengguo. Welcome. Professor Prasad just raised a very important issue of Chinese yuan's internationalization that is still a long way to go from an international currency to a true reserve currency, a true safe haven currency. So I'd like to ask all of our four guests here this. What do you think, how far should China go to make its currency a true global currency? And Professor Prasad just mentioned that it is not going to happen in the foreseeable future that the Chinese renminbi could rival the US dollar. But what about other currencies, other leading currencies, including the euro and the Japanese yen? Would you start, Professor Prasad?
Well, maybe we should let the panel speak, because I think I've said enough already.
Okay.
I never use the words to rival the U.S. currency dollar. I agree with Prasad. Yes, RMB will become more and more important international currency, but in foreseeable future, I don't think RMB will replace dollar or euro as the major international currency. But now I think the problem is for Chinese authority is a dilemma for internationalization of RMB. How to manage the transition, the process? So the classical criteria for international currency has two respects. One is so-called capital account liberalization, the whole fully Kevlar counter convert bid. The circuit is, you mentioned several times, flexible exchange rate, okay? But now the problem is, what's the benefit? What's the benefit of capped account convertibility and the flexible exchange rate? I'd like to raise this issue for all panelists. Decades, there is no strong empirical evidence to demonstrate the flexible exchange rate and the fully convertibility of capped accounts have produced any positive impact on many countries. Probably for, well, Europe or US that have a positive impact on economic growth. We don't need internationalization of any currency. We need the real growth. So I think that's a very deep question of philosophy of any monetary theories. What's the positive benefits of capital account convertibility and flexible exchange rates? So in this sense, I agree with remarks by Governor Zhou. He made remarks several times early October in IMF annual meeting. Also mentioned that China will not proceed with the criteria of classical IMF definition of capital account convertibility. We will proceed with the so-called managed convertibility. How about exchange rates? I think the current problem of world economy to very much extent has been due to mismanagement of our exchange rates. So flexible exchange rate is a very, very bad thing for the sake of a world economy. So now, how can China move toward fully flexible exchange rates? So I don't have definite conclusion on this question. I have discussion with many officials here, and I seems to me they are also confused.
Very not sure about your anti-global.
I'm not anti. I just raised the question. If we want to any currency move forward according to criteria of IMF, to very much extent, I doubt the consequences of this movement for the world economy, not only for Chinese economy, but of course for global economy. So look at now the world economy. Why the global economy now enter into so-called recession or stagnation after 8 years of financial crisis?
I think Dr. Xiang mentioned a very important debate right now in contemporary China. That is whether the market economy or liberalized economy is the right solution for Chinese economy.
Yeah, now we have discussed all these issues under classical framework of IMF philosophy, convertibility, well, flexible exchange rates. But we must answer this question. What's the benefits of convertibility? Fully convertibility and flexible exchange rate.
Let's hear some foreign perspective on this. Do you agree that China has such concerns, Professor Mayer?
A couple of comments. First of all, just in this exchange. Oh, thank you so much for a wonderful presentation, by the way. It was incredible. Just in this exchange, it's the ghost of, 1997, right? Remember what happened in 1997, everybody here? Asia financial crisis?
Yeah.
Hey, Malaysia shut their window. They did better, right?
Right.
And so China's lived with that for a long time. I actually took away a couple of things here that I didn't expect, other than your graphs and charts, which I hope aren't copyrighted because I was photographing them. I think they are, probably. I'll ask for permission. Trojan horse and stealth, right? Liberalization of the currency, And the other thing, and again, my background is not in finance, it's not in economics, was the swap lines, okay? Which is kind of Trojan horse in reverse. So the question is, look, will China again do what, you know, the rest of the world thinks is very improbable? It's the question, you know, how could a bumblebee fly? No engineer can explain it. And that is, if not get to safe haven status, get very close to reserve status, without ticking off everything on the IMF checklist. A new model. That's on the one hand, and on the other hand, you try to tick off the checklist, given your penultimate comment about Chairman Xi, no fundamental institutional reforms, given my own observation of banks, still account for, what, 60% to two-thirds of the financing in China?
More than that.
Okay,
more
my numbers are wrong. I'm happy to be wrong. You know, are they willing to move or be moved, or what's the word, disintermediated by this process, or, you know, is the political strength of the system, the inertia of the system such that this is impossible? So this is a series of kind of uncoordinated questions I have.
So what about Professor Ben? Do you have similar concerns, or do you have some preference at this point?
First point, thank you for having me here. I think the professor's, you know, presentation obviously was brilliant, and I don't think he was arguing that China should meet all the so-called criteria. And my colleague, Song Zuo, he has a point. I do actually understand his concern. By the way, you know, I was a PhD student in the United States about 23 years ago, and my original dissertation was trying to focus on exchange rate economics. Then after spending 6 months doing a literary survey, and I thought there was too much confusion, and I was totally confused. And eventually I thought, this is not something that the economists can actually solve. We're giving economists too much of the burden and responsibility to solve something like exchange rate. I think exchange rate is a lot more related to politics, related to the military power. Honestly, if there is any political instability somewhere in the world, US dollar is gaining strength. That has nothing with economics, seriously, okay? So I personally feel that that aspect is extremely important. You don't really try to solve a political or military issue based on an economic theory. So I, as economists, we need to be a bit more, I think, you know, humble in terms of our capacity to solve the issues. Okay? But on the other hand, you know, for renminbi, to a question about renminbi, whether renminbi can become an international currency, you know, as an international currency, I don't think we should try to compete with US dollar. I don't think the Chinese government doesn't actually intend to do that. Secondly, if you look at the currency, you know, you can have the currency as a trade currency. You can have the currency as an asset currency, that means doing a financial transaction. And thirdly, it's always a reserve currency. I think what China is missing most, probably, is the ability to become a so-called asset currency. Because our own financial markets are not fully open, our exchange rate are not flexible, our capital accounts so-called is not open. Maybe our strength as a so-called global currency, or as a one of the global currencies, is our ability to trade. Because our real economy, we're the largest trade nation in the world, we are, you know, still growing significantly. So if we can be a good, you know, currency to store the value, that means as a reserve currency, maybe we could actually differentiate our own, you know, definitions. Finally, I know I don't want to talk too much here, but the other thing is about the capital account convertibility, just to echo what Song Zuo was saying. I was always asking myself, what's our definition of capital here? When you say capital account, you know, flexibility or convertibility, I thought China has convertibility on a trade account,
under real investment capital. If it's a real investment capital, FDI, ODI, we have full capacity, full convertibility. It's a so-called speculative, I wouldn't call them investment, they are not really capital. They are hot money, as Professor Mai was showing me, you know, a terminology. I thought, for the hot money type of convertibility, we don't need this. We don't need this. And I think we can be better off without having that. So maybe the capital account, the definition of capital account, or the definition of capital, maybe we need to take another look at this. Okay, thank you.
Dr. Chen, do you have something?
For Chinese currency to become real international reserve currency, the convertibility capital account, exchange rate flexibility is one issue. Much more fundamental issue is, I agree with Professor Prasad, for any currency to become a real international currency, the country issuing this currency must become so-called safe haven of global wealth. This means international investors, depositors are willing to deposit their money, their investments into this country. Yes, there are three preconditions for any country to achieve this. First of all, for size, you mentioned size. China has size, of course. The second largest economy, and maybe if we have a good luck, after 10 or 15 years, the Chinese economy will have become number one. Aggregate. Second is, you mentioned democratic institutions, political institutions, or jurisdiction, or you know, legal institutions. Well, now President Xi and Communist Party, Central Committee, announced that they will build up the so-called rule by law society or nation, but not Western style. So what kind of legal or democratic or political institution to assure international investors to put their money into Chinese market? I think there is uncertainty here. More important than certainly is financial markets. Right now, in terms of outstanding volume or turnover, the Chinese stock market is almost number two, only next to New York, or maybe London, okay? The bond market is third, number third, according to some estimation. However, you know, SOE, financial institutions, and SOE companies dominate all these markets. So I don't think, at least in near future, I don't think Chinese governments will privatize all these SOE institutions. But my question is, if financial market dominated by SOE financial institutions, bankers, and the companies, can we build up a financial market with an international level, a standard civilians or regulatory framework? I have that, frankly speaking. So now we're talking about internationalization of RMB, we're talking about even replacement RMB, US dollar by RMB, all these issues. But to my understanding, I don't think the central government, the decision maker, the top decision maker, has real intention to make our currency to become the real international reserve currency. So, well, the Chinese philosophy is a gradualism. But how long will it take? The gradualism will take. So I think that's the bottom line, we must pay attention to.
But there is certainly a level of caution in China about the pace of China's financial reforms, because there is a certain level of insecurity. We open the capital accounts now is suddenly posing a very severe risk. The capital outflow, capital flight risks are very strong. So, Professor Persaud, would you explain to us how do you think, in your opinion, how should the Chinese government balance the risks and the benefits of further financial reforms? And what real benefits will the yuan's international status bring to China?
Those are very perceptive questions, and thank you for all the comments, which I think are certainly in the right direction. it is a fundamentally important question whether exchange rate flexibility and an open capital account, given the level of China's development, especially the level of development of its financial markets and regulatory frameworks, are a good thing for China or not. And I think the Chinese government, and especially the key policymakers in charge of financial market and exchange rate policies, have, I think, been quite clear that while it is a nice thing to have the RMB play a bigger role, the key question is whether the markets want it and whether markets are going to respond favorably, because ultimately what the Chinese government says, what the IMF says, is not as material as what foreign investors think the reality on the ground is like. There is a big risk to doing what China is doing. As Professor Meyer has pointed out, what the academic literature shows and what practical experiences of many countries shows, that if you open up the capital account without having good financial markets in place first, without having a flexible exchange rate, you can run into a lot of trouble. And there's been a lot of pushback even within the Chinese academic and policy communities to the steps the PBOC has taken. I think there is a logic to what the PBOC is doing. It is a risky logic, but I think there is a logic to it. As I argued, if you think about capital account opening, and going back to this comment about capital outflows, which is an important one, one question is, why do you want capital outflows? There are these two very important collateral or indirect benefits that I mentioned, that you alluded to, Professor Meyer, that diversification opportunities for households and corporations are very important in terms of giving them better returns on their savings, better diversification opportunities, which is good. But more importantly, it forces the domestic financial system to reform itself. If not, if you think about China having a national saving rate of about 50% of GDP, that includes government, household, corporate saving, all of this floods mostly into the banking system, because the stock market, you know, is a bit of a casino. You can put some money in the real estate market, that too goes wildly up and down. So what's left? The banking system. And what incentive does the banking system have to reform itself? So this collateral benefit perspective, that is, allowing money to go out so that households can diversify their portfolios, so that the central bank does not have to accumulate foreign exchange risk on its balance sheet by accumulating foreign exchange reserves, and most importantly, sort of prodding the financial system to reform itself, is important. Now, the Chinese government, in my view, has adopted this collateral benefit approach even to inflows. As I pointed out in one of the charts, most of the money coming into China has been in the form of foreign direct investment. And it's a relatively small amount compared to the total amount of China's national saving. So China does not need the money. But with the FDI comes in good technology, you get better managerial and corporate governance practices, all of which are very good. If you open up the corporate and government bond markets to foreign investors, as China has done just a few months ago, earlier this year, that brings more liquidity and depth into those financial markets, which allow them to develop so that the banking system is not so dominant anymore. And if you think about what the Chinese government did in 2007, bringing foreign strategic investors into the big Chinese banks, again, it's not that the Chinese government lacked the money, but having foreign banks come in and take an ownership stake, although a small one, in these banks, gave them an incentive to again start introducing better risk management practices, better corporate governance practices into the Chinese banks. So there is certainly some risk associated with capital account opening, but in China's case, given the way it has approached this in a very controlled and cautious way, as you say, this is the way China approaches all its reforms. And once upon a time, I used to think that what China needed to do was move forward more aggressively. But I think there is a logic to moving forward. But even though China is seemingly getting the sequence right, you know, putting the cart before the horse, I think there is a logic to it. The problem, of course, is about what other reforms are going in place with the financial reforms. If you look over the last year and a half, you know, there's been a lot of pessimism about the Chinese economy, about reforms. But in fact, a lot has been done. If you look at what the PBOC and the regulatory authorities did last year, they lifted the lending cap on deposit rates, so interest rates are now completely liberalized in the banking system. There is an explicit deposit insurance system in place. There is a move towards a more flexible exchange rate. This year, the bond markets have been opened up to foreign investors. The qualified foreign institutional investor caps have been lifted. But notice one thing. Every reform that I can point to is about the financial system or about the capital account. Two important sets of reforms have not been moving forward. One is reforms to the real side of the economy, especially state enterprise reforms. And second, even a less deep set of institutional reforms that are necessary for markets to work well. Let me give you a specific example. Last year, we had a lot of volatility in the stock markets. The government seems to want stock markets to work well as a resource allocation mechanism, as a pricing mechanism. But when the markets rise wildly, first they encourage it, and then when it's dropping wildly, they intervene, and this confuses markets even more. So the government wants stability and control there. But what is the problem in the stock market? The problem is that you don't have a good framework to support markets working well. So what do you need for a stock market to work well? You need good corporate governance standards in the firms that are listed. You need good auditing and accounting standards. You need good corporate transparency. Without all of that, to say let's reform the financial markets and have them work does not give you good results. So I think what we are seeing is not necessarily the negative effect of these financial market reforms or liberalization, but the fact that those reforms are proceeding in isolation without the real side and institutional reforms that are necessary for those reforms to work well. I'll end with one comment on a specific issue that Professor Jiang raised about the exchange rate flexibility. So first of all, on the capital account, I think both of you are right, Professor Ben Shanglin as well, that what the Chinese government has indicated is aiming towards in 2020. When I was at the IMF, you know, they used to say back in 2002, in 10 years, we will have a fully open capital account. They come back in 2003, they say, in 10 years, we'll have a fully open capital account. But now there is a precise date, 2020. But what is the final end game going to be? Again, it's not going to be a classically open capital account with no restrictions. It's going to be a capital account that is largely open to inflows and outflows, but with certain administrative controls in place so that the government still has some degree of control, especially over these speculative types of capital flows. Now, whether you can tell apart speculative from non-speculative flows is an open question, but that seems to be the government's objective. But the exchange rate flexibility, I think, ultimately is going to be good for China for a different set of reasons. What we know from the academic literature, in fact, from experiences of emerging markets in the last few years, during and after the financial crisis, is having a flexible exchange rate acts as a very effective buffer against external shocks. And as emerging market economies, including China, become more integrated into global trade and global finance, the flexible exchange rate does provide some degree of adjustment in response to those external shocks. But if you try to resist that adjustment, I mean, if you think about what happened with the RMB, when the Chinese economy was weakening starting in the middle of 2014, the RMB should have depreciated. But because of the relatively tight management against the dollar, it did not depreciate. And then when the depreciation finally happened, people assumed that this was a panic-driven move by the government, and this set off all sorts of panic. The more important issue is from the PBC's point of view, a more flexible exchange rate gives it better monetary policy autonomy. It can use monetary policy much more to accomplish domestic objectives rather than worrying too much about the exchange rate. So it's true that we economists don't know too much about exchange rates, but the one thing we do seem to be able to say with a greater deal of certainty now than we used to be in the past is that the exchange rate buffering mechanism does seem to work well, not perfectly in every circumstance, but by and large, it does serve a useful purpose, especially for an emerging market economy that is getting more and more integrated into world trade and finance.
Can I just talk about this one? I thought it was very brilliant. Talking about the exchange rate, we have been focusing too much attention between the renminbi and the dollar. Chinese government has done something, trying to do a so-called trade-weighted exchange rate basket. So the Shanghai, so-called China foreign exchange trade system has already started calculating the renminbi exchange rate index against, I think, 11 currencies. So the end of 2014, it was like 100, basically.
the basement. Now it's about 95, 96. So it's, you know, put in a broader, you know, basket of currencies. Chinese currency has not actually depreciated that much. So I just hope that we don't actually spend too much time focusing on these two things. If there is anything that Chinese government would like to see, is that the currency internationalization is going to serve the real economy needs. That means when you are trade with many other countries, when you are investing in many other countries, so that exchange not just with US dollar, but with many other currencies, as also Professor Professor was mentioning about the currency swaps, for example. These are really between China and other sort of emerging countries. So to that extent, if there is anything that we really would like to achieve, hopefully, when we talk about renminbi exchange rate, we focus not just on the dollar renminbi exchange rate. Thank you.
Talking about the serving the real needs of the economy, the global trade has been the primary driving force behind the internationalization of Chinese yuan in the past decade. But going forward, we're seeing a clear trend of Chinese companies going abroad. And China is also pushing ahead at the national level with its One Belt, One Road initiative. So will this become the new driver behind yuan's internationalization in the future? And how should Chinese business maybe out of it, Professor
Major? Absolutely. That's a quick answer. the scale of outbound investment has just gone up enormously, and I think outbound FDI exceeded inbound in 2015 for the first time.
Last year, yeah.
Yeah, was it last year? Actually, I've got the privilege of observing some of these very, very close up and personal. So yeah, you're going to see, you know, Chinese companies abroad operating in many countries wanting to conduct a lot of transactions in RMB, and, you know, that will push along internationalization. It's simply going to happen. I'm going to divert that question a little bit because I want to go back to the relationship between financial reform and institutional reform outside the finance sector. And go back to 2006-07. Do any of you remember that?
I do.
You do?
Yeah.
And Chinese stock market went, I'll do it this way, went up, right? Encouraged by the government, right? Because they were going to, a share conversion was coming along. Okay, it goes up to 6,000 something, and then poof, goes down to, you know, 1,800. I was actually out in Xinjiang.
Okay.
And I just knew it was a bubble when
did you buy some?
No, because when my interpreter was on the phone with his broker. Okay, you know, this was in remote area of Xinjiang, and it was possible through China Mobile's, you know, windmill powered a cell phone station. But anyway. The government didn't intervene. What was the word from Hong Kong? Incursion. There was no major government incursion, if I remember, and no rapid recovery. The market was a very long and slow recovery. The worry right now is the government encouraged the 2015 bubble. You know, stories in whatever newspaper write about the virtues of buying stocks. And then the government intervened and was an active buyer in stocks. But here's the point I want to make, and I picked this up from some weird data in the Wall Street Journal, which I couldn't understand. That buying of stocks, of shares, actually increased government control of listed firms. Okay? So, my gosh. So trying to liberalize the currency, but actions taken by the government to stabilize the markets have the opposite effect in the real economy. It wasn't a huge effect, but it was noticeable. I just picked that up in some sort of anomalous data I saw published by the journal. So, what's that, the law of unintended consequences? I don't know what it is, but I think it's something I would be very, very alert to.
Yes, I agree with you. I think looking forward, foreign overseas investment by Chinese companies as well as individuals will become, I think, a major driving force for internationalization of RMB, because the pace of trade has been slowing down significantly, world trade and the Chinese trade. But now, Professor Prasad mentioned the share of Chinese trade among world trade is 12%, but actually it's almost 50%, 14.6% according to the latest estimation. So I think the share of RMB settlements will increase a bit, but not faster as previous years. So overseas investment will become a major driving force in this regard. Talking about internationalization of currency, inclusion of RMB into a SDR basket is a landmark, of course. So I'd like to raise maybe surreal issue. So after inclusion of RMB into basket SDR, maybe we can, you know, consider a possibility of re-establishing the Greenwood framework to stabilize exchange rate among major currencies. So we don't talk, we don't focus exchange rate of two currencies for world economy. We must take account the multiple exchange rates among all these major currencies. So I just read a piece of paper by Wolf Martin, Financial Times, talking about the slowing down of world trade. So in the previous 4 years, the world trade growing rate is much, much slower than previous years, and even slower than, well, the world GDP growth sometimes. So that's a very bad news for world economy. Martin mentioned several reasons, but one reason is maybe, but no empirical estimation, but one reason is maybe the chaos of international money, the exchange rates. So, you know, look at Japanese yen, look at euro, look at sterling pound, look at many other currencies. Only one period appreciates, another period depreciates. All exchange rates decoupled with the real economy. So that's why my very good friends, Ben Shenlin, didn't make topic of your dissertation exchange rates. It's very difficult, you know.
Difficult.
It's very difficult. So nobody knows. So nobody can explain exchange rate right now. So maybe after inclusion of RMB into SDR baskets, I think the D20 platform can talk about a little bit. Maybe after 10 years, we can reestablish a framework to manage the exchange rate among major currencies. That's my dream. I think that will be beneficial for world economy at all.
Can I just add a couple of things? Because to support what Professor Prasad was saying, I think how far the Chinese currency can go in terms of internationalization, he talked a lot about the domestic financial markets, how the strength of domestic financial markets and the strength of the quality of institutions. I have some data to just share with you, so let's put things in perspective between the US and China. For example, we talked about the stock market. China's stock market, in terms of like a so-called like a fund raised, like so-called like a, you know, the primary market, we became the largest market already about a few years back.
The IPO?
Yeah, IPOs. You know? So even last year, I had the number here. We had about roughly $200 billion IPOs or equity follow-ons. So anything that is primary really raised the new cash. US, the number I got from US was like $32 billion last year. That means the initial public offerings and other things. But what sets China is different from United States in terms of stock market is that if you look at the total market cap of Chinese stock market, we have about 53 trillion renminbi, while the US is 27 trillion US, okay? My Chinese is renminbi, okay? So you can see the difference. But
more importantly, however, the secondary market, that means the trading side, the speculative trading, the, your interpreter, people like him or her.
What about turnover?
We had like a 5 times like stock turnover ratio.
Yeah.
While in the US and Japan, it's like about one time of the market cap, basically. So we're talking about in terms of stock trading turnover. China was much bigger than the US even. Okay? What we are missing, so we are not really, that small in terms of like secondary stock market. What we are really, really further behind with the US is even in the debt capital market. That is even more related to exchange rate and interest rate. The debt capital market, the bond market, meaning the primary bond market, China total outstanding is about 22 trillion renminbi. That's about $3 or $4 trillion US dollars. How much did the US dollar bond market raise last year? It was 6.4 trillion US. And the secondary market, even much more trading in the debt or bond market. So that means the US dollar bond market is much more, much deeper, much more mature. That provides the ability for issuers or investors to look at the so-called yield curve over the entire maturity curve, for example. While the Chinese currency, we don't bring anything right now. We don't even know our yield curve for renminbi right now. So that's the problem we have. So I think that's probably even more of a shortage for China than any other part. And of course, the institutional quality, indeed, we are very small. For example, in the simple derivative, the OTC market, the total Chinese market in renminbi is about 319 billion renminbi. How much is the US? OTC derivatives volume, 774 trillion US dollars. So the ability to make market, for example, in derivatives, in secondary bond market, is, there's no comparison. We are so small. So allow us time, We need a bit more patience about why we should open up the Chinese market right now. We don't need to. We are going to gradually do that, probably. We need to, strengthen our domestic market, strengthen our own institutional, capability for some extent. Sorry for taking so much time.
It's definitely a big point that China needs to step up its bond market construction in the future. And I'd like to go back to Dr. Xiang's a point that that G20, the world's major economies, need to manage their foreign exchange rates, at least to coordinate their foreign exchange rate policies in the future. And there are some analysts saying that the U.S., because the U.S. dollar is the world's dominant reserve currency, so its monetary policy has too much spillover effect on especially emerging markets. What would you respond to that?
I think history indicates that there was a good reason the Bretton Woods system broke apart, and I think history indicates that there is little chance that the Bretton Woods system can be revived without creating some problems in these economies. Now, one situation in which the Bretton Woods system could function well is if every economy had good policies in place, good fiscal policies, good monetary policies, and good structural policies. If you had all that, you could have a fixed exchange rate system that works well. But you don't have that. And in that context, trying to manage exchange rates, as we saw before the breakup of the Bretton Woods system, is that the tensions become too large for the system to bear. These days, what we see, and I think Professor Zhang's desire for this sort of stability may come from that, we see many countries trying to play the same game of trying to use monetary policy in order to depreciate their currencies and therefore make up for deficient domestic demand. But I think trying to call for, and I've written about this, and trying to call for coordination of monetary policies across countries is trying to fix the wrong problem. The problem is not that you need monetary policy coordination, you don't have it, but you don't have coordination of domestic policies. What is happening in most of the major countries, both advanced and emerging right now, is that most of the burden of supporting growth, ensuring financial stability, is falling entirely on monetary policy. And monetary policy does have spillover effects. So if every country is trying to use monetary policy as basically the first and last resort, because fiscal policy, you know, takes more effort, it requires political will, and structural reforms take even more political will. So it's just easier to say, let monetary policy do the work. So until we can get out of that lack of coordination of domestic policies, I think we're going to be stuck in a situation where exchange rate instability is the consequence of weak domestic policy. So I think trying to ensure exchange rate stability does not solve the fundamental problem and could create even more tensions in the global system. So if one thinks about the primacy of the US dollar again, it's not that the US has fantastic financial markets. That's true, they're very large, they're very liquid. But as we saw during the financial crisis, the US has its own problems. Some of them have been resolved since the financial crisis, but many of them have not. But in international finance, what is most important is it's all relative. And relative to the rest of the world, the US still has the best, the deepest, well-regulated financial markets. So again, the fact that the US dollar is in this dominant position is not necessarily an indication that the US has a wonderful economy and wonderful financial markets. It's just that the rest of the world is in even worse shape than the US. So I think, again, what we need to think about is fixing policies within each country so that we can get around this instability in the international monetary system that often shows up in the form of excessive dependency on the dollar. It often shows up in the form of excessive exchange rate instability. But those are not the problems. They're just the outcome of the underlying problems.
I'm getting a little excited when you say something like that, so I need to probably jump in here. I think the US dollar, let's give US dollar some credit, you know. They are a global currency. They have been serving the global trade system, investment system, and so on and so forth. And it provided the necessary public good in the global financial system. Yeah. So that's a very good thing. That's a very good thing. But in the meantime, I think what probably is the problem is for us is that, you know, while the Federal Reserve, okay, they decide the currency's, you know, outlook, whatever, based on U.S. domestic concern, they don't really take into consideration the rest of the world, which accounts for 83% of the global GDP. So that's where there's a global government, there's a misalignment between the domestic priority and so the international concern, because you are a global currency. So to that extent, that's, there's a governance here. I was proposing at one point that we should nominate the international committee members for Federal Reserve, who will represent the rest of the global economy, so that US dollar can continue to serve as the global currency. I don't think the Chinese currency or European currency can actually surpass US dollar. Right now, there's no way right now. And I don't see that in any foreseeable future. As much as I'm very patriotic about China, but I don't think it's going to take a long time. Just like we're speaking English here, we're in China. Not many people like English, to be honest. Okay? But English is like the US dollar in a social way. It's a global commerce language. So you know, as a German, as a French, you hate probably speaking English, but you have to.
Circulation of language.
So we are held as a hostage to a certain extent. And we are held as a hostage to the US dollar system as well. Okay, let's be realistic, okay? We're not going to change this overnight. But it will take a long time. We need to make the current system work better for not just for the United States, but for the broader global good. Okay, that's my point. Okay. Thank you.
So we can use a model to analyze distribution of benefit and the cost. So I pay very much attention, special attention to your slides about the returns on liabilities and assets, not only for China, but same story for rest of the world against the US. So that's why there is a very interesting argument by Professor Hausman, a Harvard University International Economic Research Institute. Well, his argument is, well, many people talking about the US has deficits, the payment, the balance sheet deficit. That's wrong. US has surpass the China deficit. Why? Because look at your return on assets. Combined together, every year you get negative return. So that means if we calculate with a very simple formula, that means your total balance of payments is negative. Okay, because your net return is negative. That's his argument. I think many people don't agree with his argument, but that reflects the so-called privilege, the exorbitant privilege of US dollar. The privilege demonstrates every aspect, not only monetary policy, but also distribution of costs and benefits. I think that's the part of real reason, at least for part of Chinese economics, to advocate internationalization of currency, to change the distribution of costs and benefits, to reduce the so-called, well, reliance on US dollar of our reserve and you know, all these things. But it will take a longer time to.
Just as a point of fact, by the way, it turns out this very weird situation with the international returns is true only for two countries, US and China. If you look at other creditors like Japan, Germany, or even a country like Russia, it turns out they all earn positive returns. But the reason why China is in this position is exactly based on this decomposition that I showed you. If you look at what the composition of the assets and liabilities, immediately you can see why this is so, because FDI returns are typically higher versus the fact that on China's asset side of the balance sheet, nearly 60%. In fact, that number used to be two-thirds until end of 2015. So that immediately accounts in a mathematical sense for why it is that China is losing money on its external position while the U.S. gains money. But all other countries are in a slightly more normal position. So,
we take a U.S. against the rest of the world. So rest of the world on one side, U.S. on another side. So rest of the world always gets a negative return on assets. So there is a famous, very famous paper, NBR, back to, I think, 2004. I forget the author name. It's very famous. They calculate the half century results of the returns on liability and assets of U.S. against the rest of the world. So their conclusion is flexible exchange rates, U.S. dollar against rest currencies, is much more beneficial to U.S. So maybe that's why after 1976, the U.S. urged IMF to change its philosophy. Before 1976, the charter of IMF always encouraged member countries to adopt fixed exchange rates. But after that, after the amendments of IMF charter, changed to flexible exchange rates. But I don't know the real, it's a real story. But according to their calculation, after flexible exchange rates break up Bretton Woods system, the gap between return on assets and liabilities for U.S. increased sharply.
So it's good to see more multilateralism in the future world economy, and Chinese yuan playing a bigger role in the world economy in the future. And we have to wrap up the discussion now, and for our audience, you can raise your questions freely to our panelists here, and please clarify your name, organization, and to whom you are addressing. Okay, the gentleman over there.
My name is Ravi Prasad. I don't think we're related.
We might be.
Thank you very much all for your perspective. I have a question on the conclusion that US dollar is going to remain the dominant reserve currency. And I just wondered how reliant that conclusion is on the US policy sphere. I guess what we've seen in recent times is growing US indebtedness to the rest of the world. And I feel that especially in the aftermath of the financial crisis, the U.S. has become more concerned about this, not only because the rhetoric around the financial crisis and its causes, partly attributed to current account imbalances. But also, you know, you see in 2010 with the US at the South Korea G20 summit saying, would it be possible to reduce current account imbalances to 4% of GDP, which, you know, other countries rejected. So I just wondered what you think the prospects are for the US dollar as a reserve currency in light of potentially changing US policy.
In a normal world, what happened in the US in terms of the financial system imploding and the US issuing a massive amount of public debt should have led to people demanding higher returns for US government debt, the US dollar weakening. Exactly the opposite happened. If you think about how much debt the US issued since the global financial crisis, the end of 2007, to say the end of 2015, it was about $6 trillion. Who bought that? 60% was bought by foreign investors. In other words, the world was willingly buying up the debt at very low interest rates of a country that had started the financial implosion. And here's the funny thing also. Every time there is trouble anywhere in the world, including in the US, so if you have an emerging market crisis, as we've seen many times recently, if you had US debt being downgraded by Standard & Poor's, you had Russia threatening that it would sell US debt, in every one of these instances, the yields on US government bonds either stayed still or fell, and the US dollar strengthened. This is weird. And in my previous book, I argued that there is an explanation, if you think hard enough, that in a world where there is a lot of turmoil, there is a great demand for safety. Everybody wants more safety. Central banks want a lot of reserves for safety. Investors like you and me want to put our money in a safe place. Banks are being asked to hold more safe assets. But at the same time, the supply has shrunk because Japan and Switzerland don't want money coming into their economy. The Eurozone isn't what it used to be. Nobody trusts corporate paper as much as they used to. So who's left? The US government. So anytime there is trouble anywhere in the world, including in the US, the dollar strengthens and US government bond yields fall. So it's a, I call it in my book, a bizarro world where exactly the opposite of what should be happening, but this happens only to the US. In China last year, the Chinese currency by October had already been, the IMF had taken a decision that it would be become a reserve currency. But when there was trouble in Chinese financial markets, money flew out of the country. In Britain, when you have troubles because of Brexit, money flows out of the country. So the US has become even stronger in its role simply because their demand for safety has increased so much. So I think we are very much stuck. And as the figures I showed you suggest, the dollar's position has, if anything, strengthened after the global financial crisis. This is not because the US is great, but because everything else in global finance and in other countries is so messed up.
That's privilege. That's privilege, which we have lost for many years. Definitely.
My name is Yuan. I'm a financial advisor. My name is
to become a global currency, you have the cost and you have the benefit cost. You can always do a cost-benefit analysis. The cost is that you need to sacrifice some of your sovereignty in financial matters, in monetary policy. That's what the U.S. needs to do as well, okay? We all need to think about, you know, what my, you know, the cost of becoming a global currency, will that be outweighing the benefit? Because as a Chinese company, for example, when I go abroad, if I can have my own currency as the anchor currency for investments, for my FDI, then I actually am less exposed to the so-called exchange rate. So there are certain benefits, but there are also certain costs. And the cost can be enormous if we don't get the sequencing right. I am
absolutely against the capital, so-called capital convertibility. Not now, not within the next 5 years. I don't think we need that. You know. And finally, I just want one thing I want to say is that, you know, I'm now focused on the fintech. You know, the last 2.5 years since I left the industry, I've been doing the fintech and the internet finance research. I can tell you that if there's anything that might threat the position or the dominance of US dollar, it's not the Chinese currency. It may be the technology, the blockchain, and many other things, which will fundamentally change the way financial transactions are conducted, many other transactions are conducted. So I think that's probably even more of a serious threat than Chinese coming as a global currency. I don't think so, to be honest.
Yeah, I think Ben pointed out, there are certainly costs and benefits, and for China it's a mixed blessing. Managing the currency's value becomes harder, opening up the capital account creates a lot of risks, but it seems like the PBOC has taken the position as, in my reading, that this Trojan horse approach that I mentioned is really important, because realistically, if you think about it, we had very few reforms other than financial reforms, and if you didn't have what forced the reforms last year, which was the desire of the government to get the RMB into the SDR basket, and if you look at everything that was done last year, it came exactly off the checklist of the IMF. Now, these are, I think, ultimately good things for China, but they would not have happened because there are enough powerful vested interests that are very happy keeping things the way they are. So it served as a very useful framework. And think about what's happened this year. I mentioned the opening of the corporate and government bond markets, lifting of caps and FI, Q fees and so on. Every one of those elements comes out of a different playlist, which is the MSCI playlist. And in May, MSCI, which has been deciding whether to get the A shares included in its index, put out its playlist, and they showed which boxes China has picked off. And I think we will see, because the June review did not go well, the MSCI decided not to include the A shares in the MSCI index this year and put it off for a few months or perhaps for a year. But there are a few items remaining on the checklist, and I'm sure that those items will be met, because that again provides a useful framework. So would all those things have happened without that external pressure? No. Having said that, the external pressures can sometimes backfire when the US Treasury or the IMF tells China, make your exchange rate more flexible, let it appreciate, they resist. But when there is a nice price like this, inclusion of the RMB in the SDR basket or inclusion of the A shares into the MSCI index, that turns out to be a very powerful impetus. And the reformers, I think, in China have recognized that while there are some risks in moving forward in this unbalanced way, it's a risk potentially worth taking, because otherwise, nothing gets done.
Lady in black.
Thank you for this chance. I'm here from the Catholic University of Economy and Business. I have a question for Professor Aswan Barsa. In your presentation, you emphasized the macro conditions, fundamental conditions for the rise of the relief. I'm thinking about why the macro condition is important for the new life in the world economy. Also, you mentioned about the integration between the onshore energy market and offshore energy market. Actually, we created the offshore energy market, and now we got some problems. So how do you think about the integration? As RMB internationalization, I think China is first emerging market economy in 10 billion to internationalize its currency. So we didn't have a leader, we were not a follower. So while we have made some missteps in this process, so now RMB internationalization, we have no example of success.
Ultimately, it's the macro fundamentals of a country and financial market structures that determine what role a currency plays in international finance. So again, governments can push very aggressively for this. International institutions can say what they want, but the reality that people on the street face, you know, traders, importers, exporters, financial market participants, that's what determines what role a currency ends up playing. And for that, you need good policies, but you also need fairly predictable policies. So what we've seen in China over the last few months is ostensible measures to open up the capital account. I mentioned all these measures, but at the same time, there was concern about capital flight. So there was some tightening of some aspects of the capital account, especially in terms of the capital flight, which they want to tamp down on. And that creates uncertainty in the minds of foreign investors. The MSCI issue is a perfect example of that. So the IMF said, okay, you ticked off all the boxes we said before you, more or less, okay, you can have the RMB in the SDR basket. MSCI said, okay, you've ticked off all these boxes, but our investors don't really believe that it's going to be possible for us to repatriate funds as easily as you say is the case. So let's wait and see how this plays out in practice. So ultimately, you know, we talk a lot about the RMB's role in international finance, and I think as some of the other panelists have alluded, the key issues are really still about China's economy, because if China's economy does well, it has good financial markets, it has macroeconomic stability, that's ultimately what is going to determine the RMB's role. And what has led to the RMB becoming so important right now is, again, that China is such a big economy, that it's grown so fast, it accounts for so much of global trade. By the way, the 15% to your right is trade in goods, but if you look at goods and services, it's actually still about 12%, so that's the number I was referring to. So China's increasing contribution to global GDP growth means that the currency is going to be seen as more important, and there is less, we referred to fintech, but overall there are these broad technological developments taking place. So the dollar was seen as an important vehicle currency. So for instance, when China trades with Russia, trade in Russian rubles and Chinese renminbi is very limited. So having a vehicle currency like the US dollar, where trades are very cheap, makes a lot of sense. But now you have a bilateral currency agreement, so Russia buys, sells oil to China, gets RMB, and uses that to finance its imports from China. The cost of trading in currencies like the renminbi, the Indian rupee, is falling. So there is no reason why the dollar should remain dominant in those spheres. But it's as a store of value rather than a medium of exchange that the dollar really remains very, very strong, because for that, you need a lot more than size, you need a lot more than even financial markets, you need these other things that are necessary for investors' trust. So again, because of the RMB, we have this bifurcation. These did not exist before. The real bifurcation between an international currency and a reserve currency, between a reserve currency and a safe haven currency. But the RMB, as you correctly pointed out, is one of the first emerging market currencies to really become prominent. And because of that, we are forced to rethink our very basic concepts. There again, unless you have good policies, these tensions are going to show up. I mean, the notion of keeping the onshore and offshore markets insulated from each other while the capital account is becoming more open was not a realistic prospect. So when the PBOC tries to resolve the internal tensions by clamping down on the CNY market, all the tensions become apparent in the CNH market. So this is not sustainable. I think ultimately you're going to have policies that lead to integration of CNY, CNH markets, and if you try to resist that, especially when there are pressures building up because of inconsistent policies on the mainland, it's going to lead to a lot of volatility, and it's just not worth the trouble, in my view.
Hi, my name is Gao Tianli. I'm a graduate student from Professor Saab. My thesis is actually about exchange rate. That's probably why I left the attempt to run in a business. Extremely difficult. So I'd like to ask one question to Professor Xia. So you mentioned that there's a well-established theory, I think, from Professor Mundell, 1966. It's the Trinity theory on international economics. If you have some sort of control on your exchange rate as well as capital account, then you immediately lose your monetary policy independence. So my question to Mr. Xiang is, if a packed exchange rate with limited convertibility on your capital account is beneficiary to the country, how would you implement your monetary policy and how your central bank follow the mandate of mitigating the depreciation of active inflation. And I asked this not because I'm a former IMF employee. My heart's always goes with my motherland.
Answer very briefly, yeah, impossible trinity means you must choose two among three objectives. I think that's there is issue of extent. So what do we mean, independence, monetary policy? And how large you are opening your capital accounts? And how flexible you will let your exchange rate to become. So that's a different scenario of trinity. For China, I think, at least in the next 5 or even 1 decade, I think PBOC will choose two managed, one managed convertibility, one managed exchange rate, and of course, independent monetary policy. And there is no definition of independent monetary policy. In this world, it's a globalization. My reading is only Federal Reserve can have real independent monetary policy. Even Federal Reserve will take account the reaction, the spillover effect of the rest of the world. Other central bankers, I don't think they have really independent monetary policy. So it's depending.
Okay, take one last question, if any. Go ahead.
Just a question for Professor Kershaw. You mentioned that China should have greater exchange rate flexibility before opening capital accounts. But my question is, how can you have a meaningful currency flexibility while if your current capital account allows? Another question, what's your assessment on China's capital account inflation so far? Recently, the Chinese official or official from the state saying that China's has already met most requirements.
So, thanks for this question. So, logically, you have a fully flexible exchange rate, or typically it goes with an open capital account, but there is no need for that. You can restrict capital flows, but say that whatever capital flows you do allow to go in and out, that determines the value of the exchange rate. So, conceptually, it's perfectly possible to have a lot of capital controls and to have a very flexible exchange rate. You don't typically see that happen because countries that have more flexible exchange rates typically tend to allow freer capital flows. But if you take a country like Thailand, for instance, it has an inflation targeting regime with a fully flexible market determined exchange rate, but there are still some capital controls in place. So the two are not inconsistent. In terms of the how far China has come on the path to capital account opening. Again, it's taken a very cautious approach, which I think makes a lot of sense given what the conditions are in China's financial markets, given the state of the regulatory system. And I talked about this collateral benefit approach, and China is, I think, the perfect example of that. All the types of capital inflows and outflows that it has allowed have been very controlled and have been very specifically targeted at getting specific collateral benefits through the FDI inflows, through foreign strategic investors into the domestic banks and so on. So I think it's, although it's gone much faster than many people would like, I think it's still been relatively controlled. At the moment, it has ramped up a good deal. And I think what the government is trying to signal, or at least the BBOC is trying to signal, is that the financial system needs to prepare become more efficient before it is open to a lot of competition. And there is a nice analogy with the WTO, where the idea was you open up to foreign trade and domestic producers better become more efficient to get ready for foreign competition. So I think of it really not so much as big benefits to China just from the capital account openness, but what it does to domestic policies and the domestic financial system is really the key issue.
Okay, thank you.
So our time is too short, and if you have answer questions, you may approach our panelists after the session. I'm sure they'll be happy to talk to you on that. And thanks again for our distinguished panelists here. Thank you for your time, and thanks for everyone's participation here. And thanks for the support from our co-host Penn Wallace Center and the International Monitor Institution. And please stay tuned for future events from the Brookings Tsinghua Center. Thank you.
That was really fun.